what a dollar means to me, winning a dollar, and the good feeling I get of making a dollar, is not as good a feeling as the bad feeling that comes from losing a dollar. It's just who I am.
Lessons learned from 30 years at the helm of FPA Crescent Fund, our rare interview with Stephen Romick.
Funding provided by Clearbridge Investments, First Eagle Investments, Royce Investment Partners, Baird, Matthews Asia, Strategus Asset Management, and Women Investing in Security and Education.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Wealth Track. I'm Consuelo Mack. This week we are featuring part two of our rare interview with great investor Stephen Romick, portfolio manager of the FPA Crescent Fund, which he founded 30 years ago. Morningstar gives the fund a gold analyst rating, noting its focus on capital preservation with an unorthodox approach. It honored Romick and his team with its Allocation Fund Manager of the Year in 2013, citing their capital preservation and strong stewardship. Since its 1993 inception, FPA Crescent has met its mandate of generating equity-like returns with less risk than the market, delivering an annualized performance of nearly 10%, falling less in down markets and recovering much faster after market declines. Earlier this year, Romick was invited to deliver the keynote speech at Morningstar's annual investment conference to reflect on his three decades of investing. I asked him to share some of his insights with us, starting with how he endured and succeeded through multiple market cycles, including the 1990s tech bubble, the great financial crisis, the COVID sell-off, and 2022's market debacle. He said, first, consider what can go wrong.
I think if you need to always look at things from two sides, what can go right as well as what can go wrong. Just the nature of a value investor, at least this value investor, is that considering what can go wrong is just about losing money, about trying to protect yourself and protect your capital and protect our clients' capital. So we always think about balancing what can go right and what can go wrong, but it's really important to place a lot of weight, at least for me and our team, to where can we be wrong. And any thesis we have where we really like a certain company or a certain asset security, we're very mindful of taking our bullish point of view and then inverting our thesis to positions like, okay, what if we got it wrong? What can happen that could cause us to lose money?
And how do you do that?
If you think about businesses and how they've evolved over the last 20 years, there's been more disintermediation that we've seen than any other point in time in history. And more businesses have fallen by the wayside. And so when we look at a business, we think, well, what can go wrong? We think about what competitors are doing, people within the industry today, and people who are new entrants to that industry, they're coming in. So if you think about businesses that, if you look at retail, and you look at how Amazon came into the market and upended the laws of retail. Took brick and mortar and sent it up into the digital universe. Why some companies were succeeded versus others that didn't. So if you look at businesses that did fare relatively well after a lot of capital investment and false starts along the way, would include Walmart, would include Target, but why didn't Sears succeed? What did they do wrong? So mm-hmm. when we looked at different retailers in our portfolio, we thought about what could go wrong. We owned a fair amount of retail, and we ended up selling all of our retail. And now the mistake that we made, error of omission, was not actually having bought Amazon coming out of the great financial crisis. We were very mindful of what Amazon was doing to the retail landscape, and we just unfortunately leaned away from retail but not into Amazon. And the same is true of the banking industry. I started out back in the 1980s working as a bank and thrift analyst for an investment partnership, among other things, but that was a significant area of focus. That was back when there were almost 20,000 lending institutions in this country rather than some 5,000 or so today. For somebody to not want to own banks when I understood them so well, going back into 20 years ago, that was pretty significant. But we saw what was happening, how banks have become very expensive, how there are lots of bad loans on the books. And we saw the risk profile of a lot of off-balance sheet leverage, you know, that had come into banks and other financial institutions, the likes of Lehman Brothers, et cetera. So we took what had been a fairly significant financial, you know, exposure, you know, largely banks, and actually took it down to zero in the fund, and actually were slightly negative, hardly worth mentioning, but we were short a small amount of Lehman Brothers.
Banks have been, from a traditional value investing point of view, they've been one of the areas that has been considered kind of a mainstay of that. So that was another kind of trend that you were bucking, right, in deciding not to get into the banks or not?
I think that in the way you're framing the question, I think it is taking on this philosophical construct of this definition of value being one of low multiple, low price to book multiples and low PE multiples. And I think that's a little dangerous. And one of our, you know, our areas of success, I would argue, over the last, you know, three decades has been just continuing to evolve and call it continuous learning, challenging ourselves to be better. And just because something trades at a low valuation, that doesn't mean it's a value, because what's that business going to look like in 5 years and or 10 years? And so a lot of these banks were just don't offer, you know, good returns on equity, don't afford an attractive risk reward opportunity for the investor, to the extent that in some cases they've been binary. Just look most recently at the likes of Silicon Valley, you know, Bank or First Republic Bank. Now, I'm not trying to paint, you know, financials with a broad brush, but value to us means investing with a margin of safety. And just a margin of safety just doesn't mean a low valuation. I mean, I think it's reasonable to argue that a company trading at 30 times earnings, growing those earnings 50% a year for the next 5 years, that would be a value if that company actually delivered at 50%, you know, compounded earnings growth over the next 5 years. That inarguably would be a value.
Stephen, for the seventh edition of the investment classic Graham and Dodd Security Analysis, you were asked to write an introduction to a chapter about your evolution as a value investor. How have you evolved?
I think the largest theme within what I wrote in this chapter intro is really this idea of continuous learning, this idea of being a value investor, you know, means to focus on a margin of safety, trying to protect capital. And you aren't protecting capital if you buy something at a low PE or in a low price to book for a business that is going to disappear. I mean, Sears looked like a value investment and did not end up, you know, performing quite so well, as everybody knows. So the margin of safety earlier on in my career, having been schooled in the earlier Graham and Doddian, you know, mode of security analysis, which is protecting yourself with a balance sheet. So buying something below book value or looking for hidden assets and being aware of hidden liabilities, you know, that might be off balance sheet, contingent liabilities and such. And what I realized over time was that the value of the business was going to afford me great protection. And I think I'm a slow learner, because I had Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger decades before who had already migrated in that direction.
Right.
And they migrated in that direction before I even entered the business. And so shame on me for not being, you know, so aware of two of the better investors in history and of their own evolution. So I'm a slow learner, but I got there. And I think it's one of the things that helped us over time is thought about that margin of safety, that protection moving from the balance sheet to the business. So thinking about how that business is going to perform over the next 5 to 10 years, and what kind of tailwinds might they have, how might that business be disrupted, is something that we really spend a lot of time focusing on today.
One of the, you know, your major lessons that you mentioned in a speech at Morningstar reflecting on your 30-year career was that, and one of them was do nothing most of the time. So is that a kind of a recent maxim that you don't need to be as active?
No, that's always been the case. Going back to to the inception of the fund in 1993, I've always was mindful that, you know, if there's not an opportunity, why press? And if there is an opportunity, lean in, press. So that's always been, you know, part of my core, you know, DNA.
You mentioned your aversion to losses and the margin of safety. And I know one of the things that you've talked about is protecting capital is in your DNA and your partner's DNA. So the aversion to losses, can you just explain that, why that is in your DNA?
I can't, honestly, I can't explain why it's in my DNA. You're born this way.
Right.
You're born, you know, the idea of the utility of a dollar and what a dollar means to me, winning a dollar and the good feeling I get of making a dollar is not as good a feeling as the bad feeling that comes from losing a dollar. It's just who I am.
But your partners feel the same way. Brian and Mark are of the same, cut from the same cloth. Is this aversion to losses?
We're accepting of price movement. Mm-hmm. We're accepting of mark-to-markets in our securities, something that, you know, the value of a business doesn't move around as much as the stock prices do. So we always anchor to what we think the business you know, value is. And so we are birds. We're different birds, but we're birds of a feather.
How important is it also to be able to invest across different capital structures? And also, you've over the 30-year period, you've also went kind of from domestic to more global. So how important have those changes and that kind of expansion of your portfolio been to your success?
Well, this fund at its inception had the charter to invest across the capital structure. So that's been there from day one. However, as you correctly point out, it's become more expansive as time has gone on, where it was stocks, and preferred, you know, it was common stocks, preferred stocks, junior debt, senior debt, convertible bonds. And then it, you know, continued to expand to private credit, to bank loans, moved offshore, did a lot more over outside the United States. We've incorporated certain derivatives in the portfolio. And I would say the importance of it is that if you were a value investor, why be pigeonholed into just doing one thing, you know, investing in one asset class? Value shows up in all kinds of places. It can show up and afford a better risk reward opportunity in a distressed mortgage loan at one point, or in a common stock at a different point. It could show up in shipping, having some shipping assets that mm-hmm. we had that has performed quite well, that Brian Somo, my partner, was the architect of. You know, it can show up in different places. And I think that if one's looking for value, why be pigeonholed into this one narrow construct of U.S. small cap, mid cap, or large cap equities? I'm sitting in a building, you know, that's got 20 some odd stories. Call that a mid cap stock. Mm-hmm. I could go look at the building that's next door that's three stories. I look at the building in Century City that's, you know, that's 70 stories. Now it's a large cap stock. Next door is a small cap stock. The analysis is going to be similar. I can look at this office building, you know, in the United Kingdom or in France or in Hong Kong. I can look at the debt of this building. Should that become attractive? So the analysis of the asset is the same regardless of as to whether it's small, medium, or large, regardless if it's an equity or debt. The structure, you know, is just different.
Right. It's a lot more challenging to have, you know, that broad mandate, right? Because you've really got to be on your toes and have a lot of people looking at a lot of different things.
It is more challenging on the one hand to consider such breadth, which I think is the framing of your question. But I actually find it less challenging because it makes it more exciting to come to the office every day. There's something to work on, more likely something to work on that we could get excited about to put into the portfolio, as private credit has been for the last decade. You know, we've invested a portfolio over the last decade of private credit, and, you know, we've delivered returns in the 14%+ range and have not had a loss to date, you know, in our private credit loans mm-hmm. inside of the, you know, the FPA Crescent Fund. But to focus on the question as to how we spend each day and harness our time, you know, we're just looking for the better businesses of the world as a starting point in equities. And we're looking for where there's dislocation, you know, across, you know, regions and sectors and asset classes.
Back to the kind of the insights and the, you mentioned four standout lessons in your Morningstar speech, again, and reprising the 30 years at FPA Crescent. And one of them, the first one was determine the strategy that works for you and stick with it. Was that something that you, you know, that again, that evolved, that you learned as you went along, or, and to tell us what the strategy that works for you is?
Well, being a value investor, making sure we invest with a margin of safety, you know, as we discussed at the outset, is a strategy that works for us. Now, if we find assets that are, if we're having a problem finding investments that afford such a margin of safety, we end up with cash by default. And that's just, you know, who we are. And that, and having the courage of conviction to not have to go and do what's working, invest in what's working, is a hallmark of the way we operate.
Right, and that's another one of your, you know, your four kind of standout lessons was, you know, don't run with the crowd. And the reason for that is?
I don't want to suggest the crowd's always wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, the point I was making in this speech, in this keynote I did at Morningstar, was just that just because everybody's doing something doesn't mean you should do it. You've got to sit back, evaluate what makes sense for you and for your portfolio. And hopefully, you know, we as investors invest alongside of our clients. And hopefully there's a few investors out there who are like-minded who want to invest alongside of us.
Right. And there really is a difference between what can be working now, Stephen, right, and versus what's going to work for the long term.
Yeah, I mean, for us, we think about we're arbitragers in a sense. We're arbitraging perception and reality. This company over here is perceived to have this great growth over the next 10 years, you know, but the reality is maybe it isn't, so we're going to avoid that company. This other company is perceived that's not going to have a lot of growth, and yet, you know, we see good growth opportunities available to it with a good management team and intelligent use of cash flow, so we're going to end up owning that company, holding that position.
The other of the four lessons, look at each new day with fresh eyes and continuous learning. How do you do that? How do you keep that sort of enthusiasm and openness? How do you not settle back into the habits that most of us do?
I don't even know that it's enthusiasm. It's about having a clear process, being open to learning constantly. I mean, it's why I read the paper every day, even things that are not investment related. You know, it could be about music, it could be about art, it could be, you know, reading the sports page. I like to you know, learn and see what's happening out in the world and, you know, be a person of the world. And I live in this world, but this world is changing. A musician that is very good right now that is popular may not be popular in the future. Mm-hmm. For me, it's just, you know, trying to figure out, you know, discover something new. I like that when it comes to, you know, music, for example. I like that when it comes to investing, looking for something new, looking for something that is the enthusiasm that I bring to it is trying to find something that people aren't willing to commit to. There's fear around it, but there's some excitement. So I get enthusiastic about, well, the world believes this, but I don't care what they believe. I like this business. I want to invest in this business. It might not be a great metaphor. It came to me as I'm speaking, but I might like a certain, you know, singer-songwriter, but I don't care if everybody else likes them. I like listening to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get some flack inside my family for still listening to Neil Diamond. I like Neil Diamond.
there are some eternals in life, right? At least for you.
For me.
Yeah, for you, exactly. You know, 30 years, half your life, you mentioned that, you know, you've spent half of your life at FPA Crescent. So what's the plan for the next 30 years?
You know, it's funny. We wrote our shareholder letter. We actually, you know, put a line in there and, you know, could be perceived as a little flippant, but we genuinely mean it, like, you know, the next 30 years, right? Or we said the first 30 years. Uh-huh. Yeah, because we've got a process we think is a replicable process that, you know, as long as we insist on challenging ourselves individually and challenging each other, I think that we are in a good position to do well over the next 30 years as well, as long as we execute on this belief set that is fundamental to us. Now, I know the next 30 years, there will be surprises along the way, but I don't think it's going to be a lot that's really going to astonish us. I wrote something a number of years back about don't be surprised, right? There's always going to be something that pops up. We didn't anticipate, 9/11, but mm-hmm. we always knew there could be terrorism on our shores. We didn't anticipate, COVID, but we always were aware that, a pandemic is something that could come a cropper, if you will. And right. so there's going to be these things in the future. And the important thing is to respond to them and understand not what's happened in the moment. When we're committing capital, we want to think about what that capital, what we've invested in, what it might look like a few years from now. And if we always have that mindset, we're always looking forward a few years and thinking about what we're buying today or not owning today, in terms of what it might look, things, how things might look in the future, if we can continue to do that, I think we'll do just fine. 30 years from now, I'll be 90, Mark and Brian will still be old men, but I'm not going anywhere anytime soon.
Stephen, one investment for a long-term diversified portfolio? Is there any one long-term investment that you would make at this point?
I'm sensitive to mentioning any one name, particularly mm-hmm. in the context for a long-term portfolio, because
right.
you make a recommendation. We've had this discussion today about continuous learning, keeping an open mind, coming in every day, and being aware of new information that comes across our desks. Well, if I make a recommendation and then new information comes across my desk, 6 months from now, then we might not own that security anymore. We might make a different decision. So I'm sensitive to this idea that there is nothing that's permanent. We operate in this with a grayscale. There's nothing that's black and white in the world. And, businesses that you're convinced will never
fail,
break down,
right.
can end up breaking down. Happens time and time again. The IBM in the 70s is not the IBM of 2023. The Sears of the 1970s is doesn't exist today. So we just are, the world changes around us. And the companies we invest in have to evolve and change too. And there's no such thing as standing still. If other people are changing around you and you're standing still, it's like that movie, Bill Murray movie, Stripes, where, nobody really volunteered, but everybody took a step back, leaving two people forward.
Right.
I mean, if you're not moving forward, you may as well be moving backwards.
An asset class?
I think there's interesting things to do. I think that like biotech, we are so not investors, experts in biotech. So I want to be very, very careful. And it's not something we've currently expressed in our portfolio because we aren't investors in it. But mm-hmm. I think about biotech as an asset, as a sector. And I said, okay, there's two significant changes that have happened, over the last, two decades that should, drive some good success for that asset class. And again, investing with those people who can do it well, which is not us. But the two changes are, one, we mapped the human genome, 20 years ago, 21, 22 years ago. And since then, it was like identifying the parts to a car. Picture the parts of the car being laid across the floor of an 18th century, dwelling. You wouldn't know what a crankshaft was from a camshaft, from a battery, from a catalytic converter to, you would have recognized a wheel, but you wouldn't have recognized the tire with the vulcanized rubber.
Right.
So for the last 20 years, we've been identifying what those parts of the car do individually, and then how they work together. And then we've inflected and we're seeing some significant drug development as a result. And then add on top of that, the bench strength in the labs has increased dramatically because of AI. I speak with a certain amount of passion because I'm on the international board of the Weizmann Institute in Israel, and I have some familiarity with this. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty amazing, what's happening, in the labs. And so with those two things, I think you're going to see some pretty significant opportunities. And so one can do it via ETFs and do the work of the individual companies. It's, again, that is not our area of expertise. But we are mindful of what's happening in this kind of health tech landscape, and we're looking for opportunities and trying to figure out ways to express it, in the portfolio. Although here, up to this point, we've not been terribly successful in that regard.
Well, speaking of continuous learning, so that this is what keeps you motivated, learning, and also potentially adding some businesses to your portfolio. So, Stephen Robuck, thank you so much for joining us on WealthTrack, and congratulations on 30 years at FPA Crescent. It's been a remarkable run.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
At the close of every Wealth Track, we try to give you one suggestion to help you build and protect your wealth over the long term. This week's recommendation picks up on one of Stephen Romick's primary investment lessons from the past 30 years. This week's action point is determine what strategy works best for you and stick with it, whether you direct it or delegate it to someone else. It should be a replicable process that you can execute in all market environments. It should sync with your personality so you don't abandon it in times of market stress. It can help you stay focused and set investment boundaries no matter what the market climate, and it can protect you from FOMO, fear of missing out during crises. Knowing the investment discipline that you are most comfortable with can also help you avoid constant self-guessing that is an investor's plague, and also help you sleep well at night. Well, next week, Medicare expert Katie Votava helps us avoid common and costly mistakes with Medicare. In this week's extra feature, Stephen Romick shares what he loves about his job 30 years in. Please follow us on Facebook and our YouTube channel. Thank you for sharing your time with us. Have an outstanding weekend and make the week ahead a healthy, profitable, and productive one.